Any real estate broker will tell you that some of New York's most attractive housing stock is in the Bedford-Stuyvesant area of Brooklyn. One block, 135 years, the cover story of the November 16th issue of New York Magazine is by senior editor Genevieve Smith. Or are we saying, or Genevieve?
Genevieve.
Genevieve? Okay, well, I made you French for a moment.
Sounds great. It
focuses on McDonough Street between Malcolm X Boulevard and Patchen Avenue. And joining us now are Genevieve Smith and three of the 62 current and former people who've lived on McDonough Street and were interviewed for the piece. Ulrich Haynes Jr., who lived there from 1935 to 1948, became the U.S. ambassador to Algeria. Lynette Lewis Rogers, a resident of the block for over 50 years, and Brooke Vermillion, who bought her house about 5 years ago. Welcome, all of you, to our show today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And Genevieve, there are so many historic neighborhoods in New York. Why did you choose this specific block?
Well, there's a lot of blocks we could have chosen, but we wanted to do two things. We wanted to find a block that showed the epic change that's going on in Brooklyn. So we looked for a block where you'd seen lots of record house prices in the last few years, a lot of an influx of new residents. But we also wanted a block that had the deep roots that you mentioned in your introduction here, where there were people who'd been there for a very long time who could tell us a lot of the block's history.
And these days you have to do more than just write an article. This story really comes alive online, where you explore the neighborhood through video, pictures, and interviews.
Right. Well, you know, there's a lot of stories that try to get at how Brooklyn has changed, and we really wanted to get at the visceral experience of living in the neighborhood, and so we really let people's stories lead, and then we used our web presentation to help make the connections between neighbors obvious, and also to draw in a lot of the history.
Lynette, many of the interviews reveal a great sense of pride in the community on this block of McDonough Street. Is it all that different from some of the other well-known blocks in the area, like Lexington Avenue, Hart Street, Hancock Street?
I don't think there's that much difference. It's just that I think on McDonough Street there's such a history. There's so many people that are homeowners there that grew up there and are still living there. So
and you've lived there almost all your life?
It was the first house I came to when we came to the United States of America.
So your family moved there?
From West Indies, yes.
We'll get into the whole business of the West Indies. And well, did you feel a closeness on the block when you were growing up?
Absolutely. We were joking outside earlier that there's nothing that you could do on the block or in the area that your family didn't know about. Because there were people watching you. There were just the neighbors that were there really looked out for one another. So, there was a real sense of community on the block.
And there were, you say, neighborhood activities that brought people together.
Absolutely. We had a block association, which I think is the most prominent reason that people kind of came together. Everybody looked out for one another. We even had a junior block association.
Now, Genevieve, you started this story long before Lynette ever got there, 135 years ago.
I guess you could say that.
A few days.
Who was there then?
The block started out as farmland. It was owned by the Lefferts family, which if you're familiar with Lefferts Gardens, they owned a lot of real estate in Brooklyn. And then they developed it at the turn of the century.
Brownstone.
Brownstone block. And the first residents after they built it in around 1899, 1900 is when most of the houses were built. The first residents were mostly Irish and German immigrant families.
And they decided not to build apartment houses, which were also being erected around that time?
I can't speak to their real estate decisions and why they chose brownstones.
Ulrich, when did you move to McDonough Street?
Oh, I would say 1935.
Do you remember your neighbors and the other people on the street?
Vividly.
Did you have many friends?
Yes. My best friend was in the brownstone next door. He was of Irish background, Charles Doherty.
And when did you first notice that the demographics of Bed-Stuy were changing?
Oh, they were changing. We represented the change when we moved in. There were very few residents of color when we moved in. They're mostly German and Irish.
And you say that there was a great deal of hostility between black Americans from the South and the ones from the West Indies?
Not a great deal, but there was hostility. The African Americans from the South didn't like the West Indian accents. We didn't talk like them. We didn't eat like them. We were mostly Anglicans or Episcopalians, and if they had a religion, it was mostly Baptist. There was a great deal of cultural difference.
And Lynette, were you aware of that?
Somewhat.
You've lost that accent. You don't accent the wrong syllable anymore.
Well, oddly enough, I mean, when we first came here, the dialect of the country where I was born is Aruba, and we really speak Papiamento, which is a mixture of Spanish and Dutch. But my mother would not allow us to speak that in the house. And because my parents were both from a British island, St. Vincent, we had the King's English in the house. So we had to speak not just English, but the King's English. So our accent was even more pronounced in English than it was in West Indian dialect.
Brooke, you've only been in the neighborhood for a little over 5 years. Where were you from?
6 years, actually. Originally, I'm from Northern California, but I had been away. I moved to New York in 1996 and lived here for about 7 years, and then moved to Berlin and London for 8 years and just moved back 6 years ago.
And you say that the block had a small town feel when you first visited, and that was a revelation.
It really was.
What did you think Bedford-Stuyvesant would be like?
Well, not that it was that I had any preconceived notion of how the community in Bed-Stuy would be. It was that I just didn't know that that existed in New York. This kind of fantasy Brooklyn from the movies actually existed, and it was very different from the small town in which I had grown up, which I never felt comfortable in and was never excited to be in and didn't connect with the people. But this was like, oh, look, everyone says hi to each other and the kids play in the yard, but yeah, they're these sophisticated New Yorkers who, you know, are smart and interesting and I want to be friends with as well. So it was that combination.
Ulrich, was it like that when you were living there in the late 30s, early 40s?
Well, no, it was in the late 30s and early 40s, it was predominantly the descendants of the original owners. So it was heavily German and Irish, and most of the merchants were Jewish, the grocery store owner, the candy store owner. The only Asian in our community was the Asian man who owned the local laundry. And I remember very, very vividly his son, Chinese, was in elementary school with me, and he committed suicide because he was teased because of his race. And that was a very sad, sad event for all of us who knew him and for the community as a whole.
Genevieve, there's a graph in the story that shows a steep drop-off in white population starting around 1940. Was that because of government policy?
Sure, right. I mean, that's, you know, there's a lot of explanations for a change like that, but probably the predominant one was after the New Deal, in an effort to kind of steer banks towards safe investments, the government actually created a map of, they split up Brooklyn by the safe places to invest and the unsafe. And Bed-Stuy was given the absolute lowest grading. And it made it impossible for homeowners in that area to sell their homes because no one could get a loan to buy them. It made it impossible to buy a home.
It led to what they call redlining.
Exactly. It's the and you look at the map and that area is red. It's literally redlining.
But why was it considered the least safe to invest in?
Well, there are two reasons. One is that at that time they were considered old houses. They were Victorian houses. They weren't modern, one of the things that they looked at was that, you know, these houses were out of fashion. The other thing was because there were African Americans living in the neighborhood. It was a fundamentally racist policy, and they thought that would bring down the value of the homes.
So, should we assume that other neighborhoods that became predominantly African American were also redlined?
I don't want to make any universal. I mean, we did a lot of history, a lot of research on this one, on Bed-Stuy, but certainly there are other neighborhoods in Brooklyn that were also redlined.
Ulrich, why did the white residents leave as a result, but not the black ones? They must have known that their property value was going down as well.
Well, as the property value went down, they became affordable to lower middle class and middle class African Americans. So it became a very desirable area for middle class and lower middle class Americans.
And one thing to interject, like they created a fantastic community in the midst of that. I mean, it wasn't only desirable for them to own homes, and they were able to, as Lynette talks about with her childhood and with the people that she grew up with, they had a really vibrant community within that.
But Lynette, one of your friends, Eileen Shea, moved out of the neighborhood.
Yes.
Do you think it was totally based on the fact that the neighborhood was predominantly black?
Well, no. Actually, her family actually grew up on, I believe it's in the Bushwick area of Brooklyn. And she was just really going back to where her family was. They were there at her grandmother's home. So it was actually her grandmother that had bought the home and was living there, was aging out. They came there. Her mother and her brother and herself came there to really help out with her mother, but their roots were really back in the Bushwick, I think, Greenpoint area of Brooklyn, actually Greenpoint.
Brooke, when you moved into your house, some people had been on the block for 30 to 40 years. Did it take a while for people to warm up to you?
No, absolutely not. Only one person did I really have to earn it with, and that was Frenchie. And of course... And it was so worth it.
You know Frenchie, Lynette.
Yeah, and I was willing to do it. I mean...
Was worth it in the end.
Oh, it was so worth it. It really took me many months of, you know.
But so Frenchie's a character, character on this block?
Not so much famous. It's just his personality. He's just a bit, you know, cautious and standoffish and not.
I had a very different experience. Most of the white families on McDonough Street when we moved in had nothing to do with us. We did not socialize. At best, we acknowledged each other's existence by speaking when we passed in the street. But, for example, my next-door neighbors who were Irish, the McQuinn family, told their daughters, they had three daughters, and they told them that they were not to speak to us. And... on one occasion, Mrs. McQuinn, I was playing in the backyard, and they had a German Shepherd dog, and the dog kept barking at me and running up and down the fence, and somewhat frightening me, certainly intimidating me, and my mother came out and asked Mrs. McQuinn if she could. Take the dog inside while I played outside. And Mrs. McQuinn said to my mother, well, she would not do that because her dog was better than my mother's son.
Whoa.
You know how that happened.
Is that why your family rented? So did you just leave because you felt unwelcome?
Did what?
Did you leave because you felt unwelcome, your
not
family?
Not at all. They left because they did not want to live next to a black family.
And they took their dog with them.
They took their dog with them. The exception was my friend who rented in their house, Charlie Doherty, who was also Irish-American. And he and I used to get out on the fire escape in the back of the house and not only talk, but we both collected those little turtles, and we used to discuss the state of affairs between our respective turtles.
I guess that's what got you into diplomacy later in your life. But why did your family leave?
Well, as my parents were able to afford a house of their own, they moved into a brownstone in Clinton Hill, not far from Pratt Institute, a lovely old brownstone. One of the things that I must say about all those houses is that the interiors, which were done in the 1890s, retained their elegance. So they were very elegant places with lovely woodwork, sometimes Tiffany-style windows. There was nothing run down or slum-like about McDonough Street or, for that matter, Clinton Hill.
And we'll return to that. We have to take a little break, unfortunately, but we'll return to that and why suddenly the real estate prices have gone, have rocketed in this neighborhood, partly, I'm sure, because a lot of these houses are still look quite wonderful. But we're talking with Ulrich Haynes Jr., Brooke Vermillion, Lynette Lewis Rogers, and Genevieve Smith, whose article, One Block, 135 Years, is in the February 17th, 16th issue of New York Magazine.
November.
Why did I say February? I don't know. But anyway, it's in the November 16th issue of New York Magazine. We'll be back right after this. And we are back with Ulrich Haynes Jr., Lynette Lewis Rogers, and Brooke Vermillion. We are talking about a block that is the subject of a feature story, the cover story, in the November 16th issue of New York Magazine, One Block, 135 Years. The writer of that story is an editor at New York, senior editor Genevieve Smith. And Genevieve, haven't many of the one-family houses in the Bed-Stuy area been broken up into small apartments?
I think that's certainly the case. There are certainly at least one house that we know of on our block, on this block, that had been really used as a boarding house for a while before it was recently bought.
Are there still many renters on the block, Lynette?
There are some renters. I think most of the homes, if not necessarily on McDonough Street, but in Bed-Stuy, are still lived in by their actual owners with some rental. Mm-hmm.
Well, I know a friend who was interested in buying a house there, and he was concerned that if he bought it, he was going to be throwing a number of people out of their rental units, and then he was going to have to live with his neighbors who were their friends. Was that something that concerned you, Brooke, when you bought your house?
No, because it was just a single family. I mean, it's broken up into two families, but only one person was living there when we bought the home. So we didn't have tenants, and now I have a couple of friends living on the third floor.
And did you? I'm sure that when you first thought of buying a house on the block, all those stories about Bed-Stuy, everybody warned you about Bed-Stuy.
I knew that taxi drivers didn't want to drive through Bed-Stuy from having lived in New York for so long. But I also, you know, I was in the mid '90s when I moved here. Everything was dangerous, and. And I knew that, you know, it just took Bed-Stuy maybe a little bit longer to catch up, but I didn't feel unsafe in any way.
And some of the local residents are complaining about gentrification. Genevieve, one woman says that older people are moving out because they feel that they have to. They can't afford the area anymore.
Well, there's a couple things. Some older people this is their retirement.
Yeah.
Their parents or their grandparents bought this house for $10,000. They're selling it for $1.5 million. They're moving to Florida, and that's the rest of their retirement. That's a great deal. So I think when you think about these issues, on every one of them, it's way more complicated than the trend piece you usually get. There are people who are impacted negatively, who feel forced out, feel like they can't afford, especially if they're a renter, they feel insecure. And then there are people who, this is the greatest day that's ever happened.
Lynette, a few people talk about block people versus avenue people. What do they mean by that?
Well, the block people, I guess the people that live on McDonough Street itself or on the inside blocks like that are more cohesive, much more of a neighborhood. The avenue is more commercial.
Like Bedford Avenue.
Yeah, the avenue is actually more commercial. There may be apartment buildings on top of stores or restaurants or something. So it's more commercial on the avenue, and the block is really a majority of single and double family homes.
In the article, Genevieve, you write the surrounding areas succumbed to crime, but this block remained a safe haven.
Sure. And when I say that, you know, we're not talking specifically about the crime, where the crimes occurred, but it was true that the, you know, in the stories that we collected from people, everyone talked about how you looked out for each other. And, you know, there's a couple guys even now who hang out on the stoop every day. And if
More
you didn't live
two.
In that block.
Brother Doc and June.
Yeah, right. If you walked down that block and you didn't know, you weren't from that block, you'd probably be like, what are these guys doing out on the stoop? But for everyone, so many people in their stories said how safe they felt having these guys there because they know that they're watching. And there's Brother has a story about how they stopped a crime. Yeah. He and his cousin cornered a guy till the police could get there. So they really did look out for each other on the block because they know their neighbors and they say hello to their neighbors.
When I was working and I would sometimes come home very late at night, and in the morning when I was leaving, Brother would be saying, I saw you come home at 10 o'clock last night. I saw you.
Oh, yeah.
I was watching you. You know, so it's kind of comforting to know that you are being looked out for.
Ulrich, in your interview, you talked about being surrounded by black achievers. Did that have an influence on the black children in the neighborhood?
Oh, definitely. I mean, we were all expected to do well at school. Now, remember the elementary school that we all went to was at the end of the block. It was Public School 70, and in the 1930s and 40s, 1930s when I went to elementary school, there were no black elementary school teachers. All of our elementary school teachers were white. Our principal, Mr. Hornekamp, was of German background. And we were treated no differently than the white students who were there. We were expected to do as well as they were.
And you point out that the black kids were more likely to go into college than the white kids at that time.
That's true. That's true.
And you went to Amherst in Massachusetts?
I went to Amherst. Two of my neighbors went to Mount Holyoke and Smith Colleges. Many of them went to Hunter College and CCNY and Brooklyn College. It was just expected that we were going to go to college.
But when you went to Amherst, you were one of only two black students.
At Amherst?
Yes.
In my class. In those days, there were rigid segregation, even at the Ivy League schools. And at Amherst, only two black students were admitted in each class. So theoretically, there were eight of us. Among 800 students at the school when I was there.
How long after Amherst did you become a diplomat? I've read that you even played a role in resolving the Iran hostage crisis.
Yes. I became a diplomat in 1977. I was appointed by Jimmy Carter as the American ambassador to Algeria. I had had quite an international professional experience with the United Nations, with the the National Security Council in the Kennedy Johnson administration. So I was a known factor. I was pretty well known among the diplomatic professionals.
Now. Yeah, go ahead.
But it was a fascinating experience, and I must say that growing up on McDonough Street was a help because it was a multi-ethnic community, and I developed an interest in people who were different from me and a comfort in living with them.
I want to get back to the cost of housing. You mentioned $1.5 million as a typical price, although there is a building on Hancock Street that's selling for $6 million, I gather. Who's buying these places? Are there a lot of people buying to just flip the houses make a profit?
There's certainly some investment in flipping going on. It seems like from the store, from the people that we were able to talk to, even the people who are flipping tend to live in the houses in between. But certainly there's cases of people who bought the houses 5 years ago for $750, selling them this year for $1.5, $1.4.
Milton Miles says that he came upon some people trying to ghost sell a house.
Right.
What's that?
Well, so, there's a lot of scamming going on. Certainly, there are, people who are, there are a lot of predators when you've got older people, especially who own these homes, who don't necessarily know the value of their homes. In this particular case, in Milton's telling of it, he was a caretaker for a house where the owners were no longer living in the house, and people were trying to break in, clean it up, and sell it off without anybody knowing.
Now, Brooklyn and Lynette, I'm assuming that people have come to you and offered to buy your house.
We get a lot of flyers every day.
Yeah. Every day.
Every day.
Every day we get flyers, we get phone calls. Had somebody call me, and of course they are ready to buy the house. I said, yeah, I'm ready to sell. What's your price, ma'am? I said, 12.5. I said, your house is not worth 12.5. I said, it's worth 12.5 to me. a lot of the resurgence, I think, of people buying homes and coming into Bed-Stuy, I think I have to speak about the brownstoners of Bed-Stuy that play a role in that. For the last 38 years, we've held one of our major activities as a house tour, where homeowners open their homes and have people come in and see the beauty of the home that's been retained.
And they tour your house?
And they've not toured my house, no, but they do tour. They've been tours on McDonough Street, both our block and other blocks on McDonough Street. Our slogan is Come On Home to Bed-Stuy, and that was originally done for the African-Americans that were in Bed-Stuy in the 60s and leaving because of the problems that were there, because of the drugs, because of the crime.
It must be said that very few African-American families, even today, can afford to pay $1.5 million for a brownstone on McDonough Street.
And people who work in public radio as well.
Well, that means that the process of reverting to white ownership is one that is to be contended with. That's now, what's happening.
Now, the idea of ghost houses reminds me, Brooke, and we don't have very little time. One thing you touch on in your interview is that your house is haunted.
I think all the houses are haunted.
Oh, yes.
People talk about the ghosts?
I sound pretty crazy because I really went into it, but I don't think there's anyone on the block that would deny that their house was haunted.
Sure, there are spirits there. There are definitely spirits there.
Over 100-year-old house. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One couple says that they've started doing Airbnb instead of having renters, that it's extremely successful for them. Does that conflict with the people who don't want a constant stream of people coming in and out of the block?
I don't see it as a problem. We've kind of almost embraced the travelers that come through the block. People are asking us questions. We're asking, where are you from? Where are you coming from? And they're asking us what's in the neighborhood. Where should they go to eat? Where should they go to for entertainment? So it's not been a problem.
Now, Ulrich, earlier we heard that a lot of people are selling their houses and moving down to Florida. Were you a pioneer in that regard? You're already down there?
Well, no, not at all. The cost of living in New York City is not friendly to retired people.
Even if they were ambassador to Algeria?
Even if they were. Oh, you don't make money by being an ambassador. Come on. Florida is full of former New Yorkers. Mostly retirees. So there's a pattern there. And we move here because there are no state taxes. The cost of living is a lot lower than in New York City.
And the weather is warm.
And the weather is magnificent.
So, Lynette, are you about to sell your house and move to Florida?
No. I think that's a natural progression, though, when we talk about a turnover in people living and another set of people coming in. Some of it is that people we have a couple right now that have just sold their home. They're downsizing. They live on the 3 floors. They want to live on 1 floor. They don't want to shovel snow anymore. That's a natural thing. There are others that need to cash out for various reasons, maybe to pay off bills or see themselves buying somewhere else. And there are people that just want to stay. I have no intention of leaving. As I said, 12.5 is my starting point, and it can only go up from there. But I do have family that I want
and
to send the house
thank
to.
You all so much for being on our show. It's been a real pleasure talking about One Block, 135 Years.